Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. As the violence in Libya continues, the impact is hitting the oil markets and sending prices up. One source quotes this morning's price as $103 a barrel. Libya is the 18th largest producer in the world, making up just 2% of the oil in the world. It's been reported its production is down by as much as 75%. Joining me in the studio to talk about what this means globally and here in the U.S., Steve Levine of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's author of the book, The Oil and the Glory. Kate Gordon is Vice President for Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. And Lou Pularisi of the Energy Policy Research Foundation. Of course, I do invite you to join us. You are seeing these jumps in prices at the oil pump. Feel free to call us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Kate Gordon, why did the violence in Libya cause oil prices to go up?
Well, oil is a global commodity, and things like unrest in other countries, natural man-made disasters always affect the price. It's an incredibly volatile price, goes up and down. People sometimes think, why, if Libya is only 2%, is it having this kind of an impact? First of all, it's 2%, but it's a particular kind of oil. It's light sweet crude, and that's a particularly valuable kind of oil, especially in Europe, which doesn't have the ability to refine less high grades. But also, people have to remember this is a world market. Even the United States sells some of our oil from the Gulf into the world market. Shocks across the world impact the market as a whole.
So, Lou, as you heard Kate say, Libya makes up only 2%. So why can't the other oil-producing nations make up what Libya's cutback has been?
Yeah, I think there's two issues. First, there's a role of expectations in the world oil market. So if you go back to 73, 74, 79, it's not what happens necessarily in the prompt period, but it's what do buyers and sellers think is going to happen in the near future.
Anticipation.
So 73, 74, Arab oil embargo, we didn't lose that much oil, but the market knew that new production out of the Middle East was going to be much slower growth. So part of the price we're seeing now is the result of expectations that the Middle East generally is going to be a tough place to expand production for a while. However, you know, this can change relatively quickly. We do know that the Saudis are well aware of this problem. They're well aware of the light-heavy problem. And we're somewhat lucky in the sense that it's wintertime. They use light crude for direct crude burn, and they're likely to put the light crude onto the market, I believe.
And turning to you, Steve Levine, we're told that oil has slipped now to below $100 a barrel as trading began on the New York Mercantile Exchange after rising above $103. How much of Libya's economy depends on oil?
Most of the economy relies on oil. It's 95% of the country's export earnings, 60% of the government's earnings, what it spends in the country, comes from oil. I just wanted to add something, if I could, to something that the other guests said, and that's the geopolitical quotient in it. It's the expectation. A couple of things have happened over the last 24 hours. One is that the Saudi kings, King Abdullah, came home. Saudi Arabia has been assuring the world for years and years, should there be a hiccup in world oil supplies, we will compensate for that. You have King Abdullah come home, the first thing he does is announce a $400 billion three-year injection of money into the economy to give to ordinary people. And traders say, hey, wait a second. If the Saudis are completely stable, if there's no trouble there, why is King Abdullah coming home and granting all of this money? I think there's concern among traders that Saudi Arabia may not be as stable, may not be as capable of replacing that volume as it has claimed in the past.
Kate, do you agree with that?
Well, I think this points to just a larger point, again, that these world events are incredibly important to our own oil prices and to not only our price at the pump, but the price of oil has a huge impact elsewhere. It has an impact on the price of goods moving around the world, huge impact on food scarcity, and something we're seeing at the same time we're seeing oil prices go up, we're seeing food prices around the world go up because of both transportation costs and petroleum inputs into agriculture. This has an impact every time something happens we can't control around the world, whether it's a geopolitical event, whether it's a disaster like Hurricane Katrina, whether it's a man-made disaster like the oil spill we just saw. This makes prices spike, and this is a very, very volatile situation. And I would argue we need to start thinking seriously about getting beyond it and getting to a less volatile situation.
No.
Well, I think the real question is, how should we transition to the fuels of the future? And should we, you know, we had a visit from the head of the Israeli Authority in charge of their major natural gas find. And I said, this must mean that you're going to switch off of your coal production to natural gas. He says, absolutely not. If we relied only on natural gas, if we had a system failure, we don't have the storage. We're going to keep our coal-fired facilities. And for the U.S., I think we want to inform the policy debate. How do we transition to the fuels of the future in a way that's robust under uncertainty?
I don't think I'm there yet, Lou. I still want to concentrate on what's going on right here and now. And one of the things I'd like some clarification about is this difference between sweet oil and sour oil that can make a difference in how Europeans...
Okay, go ahead, Lou. We do a great deal of work in the downstream sector. And there is generally in the world oil market a mismatch between the product demand and the configuration of the world refining capacity. Part of it has to do with the fact that crude slate has become heavier. But a lot of it has to do with that there's been rising demand for lighter products, middle of the barrel, distillate, kerosene, jet fuel, and somewhat gasoline. And to the extent that that product slate does not well match the existing refining configuration, which can be fixed over time, we have the product markets leading the crude markets.
The product markets leading the crude markets, Kate.
Well, and I'm more of a layperson, so I had to simplify this in my own head to understand
it.
And I will say that I do know that Europe, for example, is having a particularly hard time with the current oil prices because of the Libya situation. Europe has the ability to refine sweet crude oil. We have the ability in the United States to refine a much broader range of types of oil. So we're able to actually refine less high-grade oil and export it. Europe is quite dependent on that light sweet crude. So there, the sort of Libya is a small piece of the puzzle for us. It's a big piece of the puzzle for Europe.
But the European refiners will now be bidding up the light sweet crudes. Mm-hmm. It's a world market. And so that's going to show
up. That's what's happening.
It's going to show up worldwide. It's going to show up right here in the U.S.
Is that happening all in anticipation, or is it happening because it's an opportunity for oil companies to simply hike their prices?
Yeah. I think it is an opportunity, but it's not been an opportunity for the oil companies. I think what you're seeing are the traders whose business, after all, is to seek out uncertainty. When there is real uncertainty, then the traders can earn a lot of money very, very fast in a single day or in a single week. For example, just today, Another thing that we have to keep in mind is another presumption about the unrest in the Middle East was punctured today. There was an attack of bandits on a Chinese oil facility, a CNPC oil facility in Libya. Until now, in the unrest in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Bahrain, and also in Libya, the foreign oil installations have been immune from any kind of mischief at all. This attack now tells traders, it tells the world market, hey, all of these places, if there is trouble here, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, the UAE, any of these countries, the oil installations could be attacked. More oil supply could be restricted because of that.
Steve Levine, he's contributing editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, author of the book The Oil and the Glory. Kate Gordon is Vice President for Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. Lou Pulirisi is President of Energy Policy Research Foundation, and you, as always, are part of the program. So do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Steve Levine, do you expect other countries to step in and make up what Libya is not providing in the way of oil?
I do. One is that there is not a shortage on the global market of oil. The United States is awash in oil, and there is enough volume on the global market. But again, it's the expectation. Traders decide oil prices not on what's going on now, but what's going on in the future.
Steve Levine of Foreign Policy Magazine. Short break. When we come back, your calls, email, stay with us. Here are a few messages from Facebook. Sheila says, gasoline is already $4 a gallon in New York City. Can we expect a 25% rise across the board? And Steven says, it amazes me that higher costs for a barrel of oil equates to increased profits for oil companies. What's wrong with this picture? How about turning the oil companies into a utility and have non-oil company boards regulate the prices? Something needs to be done about all this. Kate?
Well, I think it's a good point about oil profits. Steve was saying earlier that the traders were really the ones profiting. But if you look at the Dow yesterday, the Dow was down in a number of areas because of higher prices. However, Exxon and Chevron were both up. So there is, in fact, an impact on oil profitability when you've got kind of price shocks. Now, that may not be true if this goes on and on and on and it continues to be this volatile. But, you know, we're looking at higher prices for a commodity sold by these companies. They will make a profit off of it. Absolutely agree that we need to start moving away from that, decoupling from that, get the oil companies to invest in alternatives and take away some of the subsidies they've enjoyed for 100 years and put those into alternatives as well.
Steve.
again, I think that the oil companies are not the ones bidding up prices. Traders are bidding up the price of oil, the price of products, the price of diesel and light products. They're earning a lot of money. But it is true that the oil companies, except for BP and ENI, all of their share prices went through the roof yesterday.
It's interesting. Here's another email. I'll get to you in 1 second, Lou. This from Carol, who says, how is the rise in prices via speculators unlike price gouging after a natural disaster? Lou.
Yeah, I mean, the question of what the price is a way to ration the supply in a market in which there is a supply shortage. I think you have to look a little bit longer. Return on assets for oil companies are way down in the pack, about half. Effective tax rate is very high. The real question is, how should we address this problem in terms of getting the price down? Here's an interesting statistic. If the long-run price of oil is $20 less than whatever you think your forecast number is, 80 instead of 100, the present value savings to the United States in imports alone is $1 trillion. Oil is very important to the American economy. So what we ought to do is look at strategy to change expectations going forward. And I think the president ought to release some oil from the SPRO. He ought to accelerate.
Front knee strategic oil.
Absolutely. He should accelerate the Keystone permit to bring the Canadian oil sands down here. He should give Shell its permit to begin drilling in Alaska. He probably should open up ANWR. He should expand drilling on the outer continental shelf.
All of which the oil companies would like to see him do.
But remember, BP's biggest partner was never Anadarko. It was the federal government.
Steve.
Yeah. The market already has built into it. Everybody in the world, the people who trade oil, they know that the strategic petroleum reserve exists. They know that the world is awash. There's over 1 billion barrels of oil sitting in tankers and in strategic petroleum reserves around the world. The oil price is being bid up not because there's not enough oil on the market. It's because of an expectation that in an emergency in which produced oil cannot come onto the market, meaning drilled oil, that cannot be replaced. They're worried specifically about Saudi Arabia's ability to bring, it says it has 4 million barrels a day, spare capacity in an emergency that it can bring onto the market. Can it really? So the price of oil, in my opinion, is being mostly bid up because of uncertainty regarding Saudi Arabia's ability to bring that volume onto the market.
Read for us that headline from the Financial Times.
The lead headline on the front page today, $36 billion Saudi bid to beat unrest.
Now, that's unrest within Saudi Arabia. They're concerned that what's happening in parts of Africa and parts of the Middle East, Bahrain, could spread to Saudi Arabia.
Look, we don't know what is going through King Abdullah's mind. He came home after 3 months away of being very ill. But traders look at this. The world market looks at this and says, hey, King Abdullah came home. The first thing he did is throw a bunch of money at people he thinks could be troublemakers. Maybe there is more trouble there than we thought.
Kate, do you agree with that?
I think it's an incredibly important signal that we need to be paying attention to Saudi Arabia. People have been talking about Saudi Arabia already because the king has been ill for so long. A leadership change in Saudi Arabia could potentially change policies on oil. Anything happening there that could lead to wider unrest will have a huge impact on oil markets. So
here's
it's definitely
an
something
interesting
to watch.
Email from Jim in Archer, Florida, who says the last time oil prices increased, gasoline went over $4 per gallon. Almost all food items at the grocery store increased as well, over 100%. When the oil prices came down, food prices did not. what's to stop the food manufacturers and distributors from doing the same thing again now, with consumers left with few options but to stop buying food? Kate?
Well, this is a really important point. The relationship between oil prices and food prices is very tight. Throughout the world, food prices go up when oil prices go up. We feel it in the United States, but honestly, we don't feel it near the levels that people do in other countries. In Egypt, for instance, an average family spends 40% of their budget on food. When food prices go up there, it's a disaster. Here, it's obviously a disaster for a lot of families, but we don't feel it at the level that the world market does. It is an issue, though, and we do see oil prices go up and down fairly easily. Food prices, when they go up, they often stay up because the marketers are used to people being able to pay the higher prices. They don't tend to bring them down at the same kind of rate and with the same volatility. So it is an issue.
I think also you can't discount the large volume of American biofuels, which are taking corn out of the market, which could have gone to food production. And that volumes are very, very high now.
Kate? I would just argue with that a little bit. I mean, there clearly has been a big food fuel debate in the last few years. The food that biofuels compete with the most specifically is food for animals, is animal feed. That obviously does have an impact on our food prices as well. But the world biofuel market is one factor in food prices going up. Oil prices are a huge factor because, again, of petroleum inputs and things like fertilizer, because of transportation costs. There's many factors here. I'd argue we can't turn our backs on advanced biofuels that don't have the same kind of food competition connection. We do need to keep looking at those alternatives, and we shouldn't turn away from them.
Steve Levine, this morning, Muammar Gaddafi spoke in another one of those rather rambling statements to his people and the world. He was blaming Al-Qaeda for the unrest. Time magazine reported yesterday that Gaddafi has ordered his own security forces to sabotage oil facilities, and a lot of people are worried about that. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, one, I did read that Time magazine report. I looked deep into it for the sourcing, and it wasn't clear that there was a good source for it. But that said, the way he is speaking, where he said, when I order the military on the street, this place will burn. He's speaking in very extreme, in a very extremist manner. And we don't know whether he'll really do what he says, make the place burn, attack oil installations, if that report is correct. But that sends jitters into the market. It is part of the calculation of why oil prices are going through the roof.
Is it time for a gas tax, Kate?
The $50 million question.
Yeah.
People probably know Tom Friedman came out with an article yesterday arguing for a gas tax. He's done that before. You know, there's a couple issues here. The first one is that the gas tax currently we use to pay for the Highway Trust Fund, which is used to pay for repair of all of the roads and bridges and surface transportation in the United States. That trust fund is running out of money. So if we don't come up with a new revenue stream for that trust fund, whether that's a higher gas tax or a carbon tax or an oil import fee, we will not be able to fix our roads and bridges. So there's actually an immediate issue with the lack of revenue for surface transportation. The second point, though, that Friedman makes, and I think it's a good one, is unless we start putting a cost on gas at the pump that has an actual relationship to sort of the volatility of this sector and starts to hedge us a little bit against that volatility and starts to build up sort of our ability to transfer money to other transit, to other types of fuel, allows us to get off this dependence on oil, we will continue to be this vulnerable to these shocks.
Lou.
Well, I agree with Kate in this sense, that if the roads need to be repaired, the people who drive on the road should pay for that. So we should have a gas tax. But what we really ought to do is look at our own policies. We need to have strategies that hold up well under uncertainty. And we are too preoccupied with mandates, the ethanol mandate, different kinds of mandates towards the automobiles. And what happens is, when conditions in the world market change, we can't adjust to them very well.
So what do you want the U.S. to do?
I think a gasoline tax if we could have a gasoline tax and then pull back from all these mandates, which kind of lock us in and make it very difficult to adjust. If ethanol prices go very high, we can't substitute. If the market moves in one direction or another, the economy is very inflexible because we keep enforcing all these mandates. And the other thing is, we probably should recognize that the petroleum era is going to be with us for a while. And we should open up our own domestic supply as much as possible.
Kate. I mean, I would agree that we don't want to choose a technology. Choosing oil has been part of the problem for the last 100 years. We don't want to choose a technology, but we do want to have a rational response through policy that recognizes we need to diversify. Look at the last big oil shock in the 70s. Europe takes that, decides to have smaller engines, decides to have higher gas prices, decides to invest significantly in renewables and alternatives. Germany now has almost 20% of its electricity coming from renewables because of a lot of those policies put into place. Far more people take public transit. There's more investment in public transit in those countries. We had a similar response for about 5 minutes, started investing in solar panels, for instance, and alternatives. As soon as the gas prices came down, we went back to business as usual. We cannot keep doing that.
Kate Gordon of the Energy Policy, she's vice president for energy policy at the Center for American Progress. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Steve, I know you want to get in on that.
I just wanted to say that the impression one gets from the narrative that's out there, from the news and the way people are speaking, is that nothing is being done. We're in a blip, I think, right now of a very difficult period now and going forward over the next several years. But the United States and other countries, including China, are taking steps toward reducing the reliance on fossil fuels. The whole push toward advanced batteries, toward electric cars, this is a trajectory that will take hold. It's a 20-year trajectory. And over time, over the next 10 years, 15 years, the world is going to start using less oil. And the kind of volatility that we're seeing now is going to be reduced.
Kate.
It's happening.
Sorry.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And I just would reiterate that that's partly because of policy. I mean, we saw the American Recovery Act put a fair amount of research and development money into the advanced battery sector. We have seen Michigan have a big increase in jobs from that. We're also now selling electric drivetrains to China. That's because of that innovation. That's partly because of policy. I'm concerned because the current budgets being floated around Congress absolutely decimate our research and development budgets, including in advanced batteries, including in the applied research program at DOE. If we don't continue making those kinds of investments, we won't be able to innovate our way out of this. We'll be in a very difficult situation.
Lou.
I think one of the things you have to recognize is that the countries are all going to respond a little differently. We're probably going to see more full electric vehicles in China, more fuel cell, gas-oriented kinds of cars in India. And in the U.S., we're going to have more advanced hybrids are going to do much better than full electric vehicles. But the real issue is, what happens, you know, how much of the technology that's mandated by the government is up against catastrophic financial risk? Because as fiscal fatigue sets in, and if the Iraqis produce, which we believe they will produce, we think the long-run price of oil may be substantially below $100 a barrel. And those programs will undergo serious financial stress.
So you believe we ought to stick with oil, find it wherever we can, and at the same time investigate other forms.
I think we should have a strategy that allows us to transition to the fuels of the future that maximizes economic growth in the United States.
Kate?
Oh, I agree with that statement. I just think that we need to do so in a way that really diversifies our fuel sources and the types of vehicles we drive and the ability for people to take transit. Look, you know, Ken Green at the American Enterprise Institute, not usually a friend of my institute, but I'm quoting him, has said even if we produced 100% of our own oil, we would be vulnerable to world price shocks because this is a global market. We cannot produce enough to affect the global market of oil. The second thing is that, you know, you hear a lot about opening up new drilling, about ANWR. Currently, the oil and gas industry has leases on 32 million acres in the West it has not yet developed. It's not as if there aren't opportunities right now on the table. We need to be looking beyond that. We need to be looking beyond this very risky and volatile sector to a range of other sectors.
Steve.
I agree with Lou that the policies, the current policies we have, are not going to be around forever because there will be fatigue on subsidizing advanced batteries, on subsidizing electric cars. But Moore's Law, the law that technology doubles in efficiency every year, year and a half, will take hold in batteries, in electric cars. I think that, over the next few years, batteries will become competitive with the internal combustion engine. The price of oil, I agree with Lou, is going to come down over the coming years, but electric cars are going to be able to compete with them side by side.
Steve Levine, he's contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Kate Gordon of the Center for American Progress. Lou Pularisi of the Energy Policy Research Foundation. When we come back, we'll open the phones, take more of your email, your messages. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. By Visa, whose Visa signature card offers access to travel partners including airlines at visa.com/signature-southwest. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
The dramatic rescue of 33 Chilean miners captured the world's attention last October. The story of their survival deep underground, the operation that brought them to the surface, and the haunting aftermath of their ordeal. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As far as oil price spikes around the world, we're getting lots of emails that are similar to this one from Armand, who says, what I'd like to know is why gasoline prices go up at the pumps almost immediately as prices of oil per barrel go up. How can gasoline distributors do this? Presumably, this gasoline has already been produced and paid for. How does this work, Lou?
Well, at the retail level, he's going to have to repurchase his supplies as that goes down at the higher price. And in fact, many times the retail business, many times they'll purchase the next slug of gasoline at the high price, and the price will fall now at the pump, and they'll be stuck with that inventory. So how it works in the marketplace is that the The price is bid up through supply and demand, and it's rationed out exactly in real time.
But if they've already bought it at the lower price, why should they be allowed to boost that price immediately?
If you're suggesting we should impose price controls.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that.
I would suggest you go back to look at the period under the Nixon administration and what a disaster that was.
Steve, you're shaking
your head. That's right. It didn't work. It didn't work during the Nixon era. Look, it's very, very simple. The gas wholesalers can earn more money. The international price for gasoline, for oil has risen. They can earn more money. So the gasoline sitting in those tanks underneath your neighborhood gasoline station is more valuable, so they're going to charge more for it.
All right, let's open the phones to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I'm listening. I'm listening to the battle of the institutes and their corporate benefactors here. So let me give you the view looking from the bottom up. I'm a long haul trucker from Oregon, independent trucker, owner operator, and right now I'm looking at about $6,000 a month just by fuel for my one truck. I'm here in Orlando, Florida. Fuel here has been jumped up about $3.68 a gallon. That's cash price, about $3.73 credit. So just the fuel of my truck today is going to cost me $883, which to me is just both the 6 grand and $883 are staggering numbers. I mean, just it's unbearable. It can go from excruciating to unbearable. I mean, I use the word unbearable. That's pretty much what it is. And I think the answer to this is just curb the speculation. The commodity markets, which your guests seem to be defending, these guys live in their own world of own creation and control, where the sky's always falling and chicken little rules.
Lou or Steve, either one.
I'm somewhat sympathetic, and I think that the fundamentals you can argue, and we have our own debate even within our own organization, how much of these price spikes are driven by say herd instinct or financial manipulations
or speculation.
But the question is do we want to eliminate the speculation? Because speculation can be quite valuable because it allows for the transfer of supplies over time. It allows people to take positions over time. Let's take something we know a little bit about, natural gas markets. The strip price for natural gas, which speculators operate in, for 2016 is now $6 instead of $8. So those same speculators who are allocating supplies over time in the liquids market are also doing it in natural gas. But why is the price fallen by over $2 in the future for natural gas? Strictly because expectations of the market are that we have a lot of supply.
Steve.
Again, I'm going to agree with Lou in one sense, and that's to say that speculation, the trading market, is necessary in order to reduce volatility. It creates a positive there's a positive result in the market. However, there is a move here in Washington to make it more expensive to speculate, and I think that's a smart thing to do. A trader should not be able to go into the market at a very, very low price and trade and bid up the price of oil.
And you see that that's what's happening. Prices being bid up. Kate?
I mean, I will leave it to the experts here on either side of me on speculation, but I will say I'd like to see Lee and others like him have more choices. I mean, I think if oil is at a particular high, there should be an ability to have an alternative. There's great work being done on natural gas engines, especially for trucks like the one that Lee drives and for large vehicles with compressed natural gas. There's also biodiesel and advanced biodiesel that can be very effective in those large trucks, especially out in the Northwest. I'd love to see the ability to make a different choice when the price is too high.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. I'm curious why historically the price of gas per gallon is roughly double in Europe and most of Asia as it is in the United States.
Lou.
Strictly taxes.
Taxes. Doesn't that make sense, you guys?
Taxes that were raised for particular reasons. I mean, taxes that Europe has decided to raise to pay for things like public transit, for instance.
Right.
There's a reason that such a higher percentage of people working in urban areas in Europe take public transit than they do drive and than they do here. It's because there's a lot more investment going into that sector. Much of that comes from taxes.
And actually, to get back to the trucker's question, the high taxes in Europe have been part of the motivation to move more towards diesel fuels than gasoline, because diesel is more efficient. You can get an efficiency of range anywhere from 15 to 30% with a diesel engine. And so when the price of the transportation fuel is high, there's a tendency to move towards using distillates.
If the unrest that we've seen in the Middle East and Africa continues to spread, which countries will speculators be looking at, Steve?
It's already pretty clear. Speculators are looking at one single country, and that's Saudi Arabia. All eyes are on Saudi Arabia, and I just think that's where it's going to stay. It would be a good idea. We've received signals that Saudi Arabia is going to increase its output. It produces now about 8.6 million barrels a day. If it increased that, it would take several days to do it. But if Saudi Arabia announced, we're going to start producing 9 million barrels a day, I think that would go pretty far to calm the markets. I'd be interested to hear what Lou thinks about that.
I agree. It may not totally fix the problem unless it's a light sweet crude. We do need in the near term more supplies of light sweet crude.
Does Saudi Arabia produce light sweet crude?
Saudi Arabia does, in fact, but they use a lot of it internally, a lot of it into their own refining sector. But because it is wintertime now, they use a lot of light sweet crude for direct crude burn in the production of electricity. But because it's wintertime, they have the supplies, and they're well aware of this. And I believe they will put the light sweet crude on the market.
All right. To Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi there, Joseph.
Yes. I would like to know if they know what the capacity is in Iraq and what percentage, you know, what are they producing now and what are they kept producing since we went over there and spent our money. I don't see why we can't have a short-term solution and a long-term solution. And Iraq could be the short-term if they boost their production and make them use some of that money, some of the profits, to put electricity in their country and a decent sanitation system.
All right, Lou.
I think Iraq is a fascinating story. We've been studying it. We've had a huge program on Iraq for over a year. We're going to send a team into Basra. And I can tell you that the Iraqis have a amazing program. Now, whether they can meet it all remains to be seen. But they're hitting all their targets. And they have major infrastructure issues. And the notion that they could produce, say, 14 million barrels a day by 2017 or 2018 is probably unrealistic. But they might be able to produce half that amount.
Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Hi there, Lynn. Lynn, are you there? Lynn, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Please go right ahead.
Yes, I live in Birmingham, Alabama, but we lived in Germany for a year, and I saw how efficient the use of mass transit, especially the trains there. I don't understand why we have to keep depending on oil, and we've talked about this so many times when we could use mass transit and eliminate that oil, that need. Plus, by taxing these poor people that are trying to do their jobs and working, that's just making a hardship on our people here in the United States.
Thanks for calling, Lynn. Kate.
Lynn has a great point, and transit's a little bit more complicated in the United States for a lot of reasons. The European cities were built at a time where there weren't any cars, which means they tended to be built more densely, they tended to be built closer together, the streets tended to be narrower. It's easier to do public transit connections in cities of that size. We built a number of our cities, especially in the West, around the automobile, so it's a very auto-driven culture. That doesn't mean that we don't have the innovation and entrepreneurship and ability to change that and to do better rail between cities, high-speed rail especially, and to do much better mass transit within our cities. Our major problem, and Lynn touched on this, is a revenue problem. We need to be able to pay for those investments. Where do we get that money? The Highway Trust Fund has traditionally been where we get all the money for our transportation investments. It's based on the gas tax, and it's running short, and we needed to fix our roads and bridges. So where do we do that kind of investment? The president has tried to put a number of new investments into high-speed rail, and folks around the country know that a number of governors are now returning that money because high-speed rail has become a politicized issue. Governor Walker in Wisconsin just returned the money from Wisconsin, saying he doesn't want high-speed rail between Madison and Milwaukee, the two largest cities in that state, 75% of the population of that state. That kind of attitude toward public transit is half of our problem. And the other half is simply a revenue problem, which kind of brings us back to that gas tax issue.
All right. To Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning. I am more liberal and more less inclined to agree with the gentleman who seemed to back the industry, but I have to point out that they're right on two things. With supply and demand, Diane, you even seemed to think it was unfair that gas goes up when the oil was refined a long time ago at a lower price. If the price of gold doubles today and I go to a jewelry store, all the rings will be more expensive tomorrow, even though the gold was purchased when gold was cheaper. And similarly with the gas, there's a lead time, because when the price of oil goes down, gas at the pump goes down, even though the oil used to refine it might have been bought at a higher price. We accept it in every other commodity.
But there's one difference, Craig. I don't have to buy gold. I do have to keep my car going, and that
I agree. If you want to change the whole structure and have it regulated or use it as a utility, I think that you have a reasonable argument. But since it is private companies laying out the money of their investors, it's also reasonable for them to expect a certain margin. If Apple has a chip that goes up in price, their profits are going to go up because their margins will go down if they keep selling their items at the same price.
But, you know, we have reached a point in this country, I think, where we have begun to worry less, far less, about the consumer than we have the investor or the purchaser or the ordinary consumer. And that's what's gotten us into trouble. I think companies ought to be thinking a little more, or put it another way, a little less about their investors and a little more about the consumers. Kate, any comment?
Well, it just would say, I think there is a real difference between commodities we rely on and those that we don't. And as I was saying earlier about the way that the United States in particular is designed, many people in this country absolutely rely on their cars.
Absolutely.
Especially in rural areas. There aren't a lot of other options. And most of those commodities we rely on are regulated more in some way.
Kate Gordon of the Center for American Progress, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I have two questions for your panel this morning. Number one, if we impose a new highway tax, what guarantee do we have that Congress will not use it for normal general spending in their budget and not apply it toward repairing the highways? Secondly, why don't we convert cars to natural gas, which is the easier of the two methods, rather than electric, go natural gas, as are the majority of all the new diesel trucks going to natural gas?
Okay, go ahead.
To the first question, the answer is simple. You have no guarantee. Congress does all kinds of crazy things, and there's no evidence that they'll stop doing crazy things. If they want to use the money for something else, they'll do it. It's a political process. On the natural gas, I think that's very interesting. Clearly, for fleet vehicles, it's working out, and it can be quite cost effective and make a lot of sense. But here's the problem: we can't get people to make a left turn to save a nickel a gallon. And the natural gas, I think, has a lot of opportunities in the transportation sector, but it also comes with some burdens. It takes up a lot of space. It takes a long time to fill. There's a lot of infrastructure. But there is an interesting development out there. The value of natural gas vis-a-vis the value of crude oil has opened up. It's spread up a huge amount. And the opportunity for gas to liquids is now something that ought to be looked at very carefully.
Kate?
Well, first on the Highway Trust Fund, I mean, technically Congress can do whatever they want, but the fact is that the Highway Trust Fund exists. It's a vehicle we've already created. It's a congressional institution. It would be very hard to change its mandate. And currently, higher gas prices would fairly automatically go into that trust fund, be allocated in a similar way to they are now. I'm not a fan of that allocation. 80% of it goes straight to the highways, only 20% to mass transit. I think we should look at that. But honestly, we can't even talk about the allocation until we get some more money in there. But the second thing on natural gas, I agree with Lou. I think it is a very interesting, and the caller, it's a very interesting technology. There's actually an attempt right now, a bipartisan attempt in Congress, to get a bill passed called the Natural Gas Act that would make it far easier for especially fleet vehicles and large trucks to use natural gas. And I think that's a great investment.
Steve.
I was just to add to those really good answers. One is that I think you do all of these things. So the caller, the very first caller, Lee, was talking about the high prices he was paying to fill up his truck.
The Diane Rehm Show is
But if he was using CNG, which is it's possible to use compressed natural gas for long haul trucking, for fleet trucking. That would reduce his price of transportation. And in the same way, if we had high-speed rail on the East Coast, that would reduce the use of oil as well.
Steve,
and we should do both.
Steve Levine, Foreign Policy Magazine. Kate Gordon, the Center for American Progress. Lou Pularisi of the Energy Policy Research Foundation. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.